Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading to you today from the USA Sports Weekly for March 4th through the 10th. We're going to start with a couple of baseball stories from Joe Mock with USA Today and from San Diego. The fledgling World Baseball Classic played games in 2006 and 2009 at San Diego's Petco Park, a major league venue with a lot of seats to fill. Brian Moore was a police officer there at the time. Other cops and I were out on the streets handing out free tickets to people to get them to attend. There weren't a lot of takers. This week, the World Baseball Classic kicks off its first round games in sites stretching from Japan to Florida, and the interest is quite a bit different than 2 decades ago. Advanced ticket sales have really exceeded expectations, says Jeremiah Yolkut, Major League Baseball's senior VP of global events. In all the markets, we've seen great interest. The original World Baseball Classic was announced in 2005, with the first tournament held the following March. I think the driving force, and this is still very true today, is that baseball has always been a global sport, Yolkut says about the original reasoning for the event. In the early 2000s, then-Commissioner Bud Selig and other executives at MLB saw the intense interest in the Olympic Games, which adopted baseball as a medal sport in 92, and FIFA's World Cup Soccer. Coupled with the globalization of baseball, they saw an opportunity. The WBC was our moment to be able to bring players to the global stage in the countries from where they were from and where they developed, says Yolkut. Bud used to talk about wanting a global World Series, and I think the WBC has become the answer to that. The initial WBC in 2006 was not without its challenges. The MLB Players Association, as well as several owners of MLB clubs, voiced concerns over matters ranging from potential injuries occurring during the games to standards for drug testing. The Nippon Professional Baseball Organization in Japan, whose participation in the tournament was critical to its success, didn't like that it was scheduled in the spring and not enough games were slated to be held in Asia. Following months of negotiations with all parties, the initial tournament commenced on March 3, 2006, in the Tokyo Dome, with 16 countries invited to participate. Other venues utilized were in Puerto Rico, Scottsdale, Anaheim, California, Orlando, Phoenix, and San Diego. Japan, featuring MLB stars Ichiro Suzuki and Daisuke Matsusaka, beat Cuba in the title game 10-6 at Petco Park. The other semifinalists were South Korea and the Dominican Republic. The success of the initial tournament prompted a second WBC in 2009. Mexico City, Toronto, Miami, and Los Angeles were added as host cities, with the championship game at Dodger Stadium yielding another win for Japan. The other semifinalists were South Korea, Venezuela, and the U.S. The rules for qualifying for the 2013 WBC changed. Instead of countries being selected by MLB, a qualifying round was introduced. The 12 highest finishing teams from the previous tournament qualified automatically, while 16 other countries vied in qualifying rounds for the final 4 spots in the main 3 rounds of the tournament. This necessitated additional sites for the qualifying rounds. In addition to the Spring Training Park in Jupiter, Florida, the new sites were in Regensburg in Germany, New Taipei City in Taiwan, and Panama City in Panama. Advancing from those qualifying rounds were the teams from China, Brazil, Spain, and Australia. Winning the 2013 WBC was the Dominican Republic, topping Puerto Rico 3-0 at what is now called Oracle Park in San Francisco. The United States advanced to the championship game for the first time in the 2017 WBC, beating Puerto Rico 8-0 in front of 51,565 fans at Dodger Stadium. Hosting games for the first time that year were Mexico in Mexicali and Zapopan, Australia at Sydney, South Korea in Seoul, and New York City in Brooklyn. Due to COVID-19, the next WBC occurred in 2023. The number of countries participating in the main three rounds rose to 20. There were no first-time hosts in the tournament, which was won for a third time by Japan, knocking off the U.S. in the title game 3-2 in front of 36,098 people in Lone Depot Park in Miami. Shohei Ohtani was named the WBC Most Valuable Player. The March 21st, 2023 title game was watched by over 5 million viewers in the U.S., a strong result for a baseball game. In Japan, though, 62 million viewers tuned in, despite the game being played during the early morning there. Therein lies an issue with the WBC. From its inception, the tournament has been wildly popular in Asian and Latin American countries, but less so in the U.S. While American fans are decidedly more interested in the tournament today, in the WBC's early years, much of the fandom came from other countries. Hence, the need for San Diego's law enforcement officers to give away tickets. Moore, who retired from the force after 24 years in 2023, was an early adopter of the WBC. He's a globe-trotting baseball fan of the highest order, having attended games in 37 foreign countries. I always enjoyed the World Cup in soccer and figured baseball needed something similar. He did travel to Japan twice in 2005 to see games, and that gave me a taste of international ball. It was fun to watch teams from different countries and their style of play. So, while he was excited for the inception of WBC play, my American friends weren't. They'd tell me, "It's only an exhibition. What's the point? How is anyone going to beat the U.S.?" They were ignoring the fact that MLB teams are made up of players from all over the place. He points out that the WBC provided a lifeline for the sport in a number of other countries when the Olympics dropped baseball as a medal sport following the 2008 games in Beijing. With no need to maintain facilities for the Olympics, many countries would have cut all funding for baseball. Instead, the lure of qualifying for the WBC kept the sport alive. Moore has seen the interest in the WBC in foreign countries remain sky high. To those fans, they feel like they are the little brothers out to get the U.S., so it means way more to them. MLB acknowledges that Americans don't feel the fervor early on, or rather didn't feel the fervor early on. With any property, when it's in its infancy, it takes time for it to develop, says Yogurt. Whatever you've seen over time, whether outside the U.S. or inside, is that it's gained momentum and it's gained speed. The WBC is only 20 years old, so it's not surprising that more and more visibility has happened, both internationally and now certainly domestically. When the U.S. won the tournament at Dodger Stadium in 2017, it allowed the interest to snowball, says Yogurt. There was more and more relevance in the U.S. because now there was that pridefulness that we are in the greatest country when it comes to baseball. This year's WBC started last year with qualifiers in Tucson, Arizona, and Taipei City in Taiwan, with both sites hosting WBC contests for the first time. The main three rounds with the 20 qualifying countries are being held in Miami, Tokyo, Houston, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, with Lone Depot Park in Miami hosting the championship round. With only six sites hosting WBC games this year, competition among cities interested in hosting was intense. Right after the 23 WBC, we had a lot of interest from venues across the world about hosting one of the pools, says Yolkut. An initial list of 22 interested cities was narrowed to 11 when it came time to respond to MLB's request for proposal. Yokult explained that the thorough review process consisted of several components. First, we need the best venues in the world. Second, the venue had to demonstrate that the game can be played at the highest level possible in conditions that are conducive for major leaguers to be involved. Third, there needed to be the right blend of international sites and U.S. sites. Fourth, the market needed to be, or rather to offer, commercial interests behind it, because in order to be able to put on the level of tournament that we want, we need to work with commercial partners. Fifth, the fandom in that market needs to possess the enthusiasm to provide energy at the games. MLB had learned that the Dominican, Puerto Rico, and Mexican groups have that energy. Finally, we have to be mindful of the weather so we can complete the tournament on time, noting that a major leaguer would have to get back to spring training and we've got to be ready for the regular season. Providing major assistance in assessing and then preparing the playing facilities is Murray Cook, president of Brightview's Sports Turf Division. He has been MLB's official field consultant since 1991. Since the first tournament in 2006, I've been the ballpark guy and the field guy and the venue preparation guy across all of the WBC's international venues, and that's still true today. We do all the site reviews, locker rooms, padding, netting, the lights, anything that affects the players. And with better facilities came increased interest in the sport in other countries, particularly in Europe. It really sparked this wonderful growth of the game worldwide. Cook adds that the strategies and techniques they employed in creating new facilities and completely reimagining clearly subpar parks in those countries made possible future jewel events for MLB. The WBC was a precursor to upgrading venues in a temporary way so that we could play the games and then break it back down. This strategy paved the way for MLB to create temporary ballparks on an abandoned golf course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, for a regular season game in 2016, and in a cornfield for the two Field of Dream games in 21 and 22 at the movie site in Iowa. It's really exciting to see what the WBC has done for baseball, Cook says, and even though it's taken a while, fans in the U.S. have realized it. And now for a little commentary from Bob Nightingale with USA Today. Chicago Cubs center fielder Pete Crow Armstrong can't wait to catch up again with former roommate Kansas City Royals shortstop Bobby Witt Jr. and hang out with one of his heroes, Philadelphia Phillies first baseman Bryce Harper. San Francisco Giants ace Logan Webb plans to hang around as much as possible with three-time Cy Young winner Clayton Kershaw, picking his brain until the future Hall of Famer gets tired of him. Cubs third baseman Alex Bregman, who is hosting a few of his new teammates this week, including Boston Red Sox slugger Roman Anthony, wants to spend as much time as possible with the New York Yankees three-time MVP Aaron Judge. The World Baseball Classic is back, with Team USA arriving over this past weekend in Arizona, joined by four other national teams. The Americans were scheduled to gather for a team dinner and have their first practice in Scottsdale on March 2nd, with exhibition games the next day against the San Francisco Giants and 2 days later against the Colorado Rockies before flying to Houston for the first round of the WBC. They have assembled easily their finest team in WBC history, loaded with future Hall of Famers, MVPs, Cy Young winners, and All-Stars. It's gold medal or bust after winning the WBC in 2017, but losing to Japan in the finals in 23. While Team USA has had difficulty attracting pitchers and a few stars like Aaron Judge in the past, this time it had virtually everyone begging to play for them. No one took a bigger financial gamble than the Detroit Tigers' two-time Cy Young winner, Tarek Skubal. He's in line for a historic $400 million-plus contract as a free agent after the season, and everyone would have understood if he declined. He originally planned to decline, but after talking to several of his close friends who were playing, he relented and signed up. It says a lot about him as a competitor, Crow Armstrong tells USA Today Sports. It's sick that he wants to do this on his walk year. His mound presence is how a lead singer would command a crowd or a really good speaker would command the room. It's almost like everybody goes silent when he takes the mound. Still, as much as Scoobal is looking forward to representing the United States, he also realizes he needs to be smart about the potential risk. He informed USA Today, or rather Team USA, he will pitch just once for perhaps two or three innings, likely March 7th against Great Britain, and return to the Tigers camp then in Lakeland, Florida. "I'd love to do the whole thing. It's just a timing thing," Scoobal told reporters in Florida. "It kills me. I think I got the best of both worlds getting a start, being in the room, learning from all those guys, but also by being healthy and pitching this season." Pitching just once was a perfect compromise between the Tigers, Team USA, and his agent, Scott Boras. So, will Boras be traveling to Houston to keep an eye on Scoobal? "No," he told USA Today Sports. "I'll be home on my couch watching with a knot in my stomach." Team USA could have had former MVP Mookie Betts and All-Star outfielder Kyle Tucker, too, but with their wives soon due with babies, they stayed home. Dodgers first baseman Freddie Freeman, who has played in the past for Team Canada, is staying back in Dodgers camp, too. So is Yankee first baseman outfielder Cody Bellinger, who declined an invitation, though teammate Paul Goldschmidt ended up on the team. Minnesota Twins starter Ty Bradley elected to stay put to be with his new teammates instead of joining Team Mexico with Jose Urquidy, Cody Ponce, Aaron Sanchez, Roman Urias, Isaac Paredes, also not playing for Mexico. Team Puerto Rico will be without Houston Astros third baseman Carlos Correa and the New York Mets shortstop Francisco Lindor, while Venezuela is missing second baseman Jose Altuve. And while four-time MVP Shohei Ohtani plans to play for Japan again, there won't be a sequel to the 2023 WBC when he struck out USA captain Mike Trout to win the gold. He will strictly be a DH and won't pitch. "Now it's time for us to go out there and change the script," said Judge, USA's team captain. "I'm excited, just like I was the day I committed. It's going to be fun. The boys are pumped, and it's time to go to work." The WBC experience will be emotional for players like Pittsburgh Pirates ace Paul Skenes and Boston Red Sox lefty Garrett Whitlock. Skenes spent 2 years as a cadet at the Air Force Academy and still wants to serve his country when his playing career ends. Whitlock's father, Larry, served in Vietnam, and he cried when Whitlock broke the news to him. "That's why it's such an honor to be me," Whitlock told reporters February 28th in Fort Myers, Florida. "Forget the stage and everything else, but just to represent the country. I'll never be able to sacrifice like so many of our service members do, or did, but it's the chance, hopefully, we can bring them some joy." Skenes, who plans to start twice in the tournament along with Webb, says he wouldn't miss the WBC for all of the world. "We're doing it to represent the men and women that are fighting for us, along with many other things that make this country the greatest country in the world. That's what I believe. That's why I wanted to serve, why I went to the Air Force Academy." For Harper, who last represented the USA in international competition when he was 16 years old, says he will wear number 24 in the tournament, the number he wore back in 2009 when he still was a teenager. "There's nothing like it," Harper told reporters in Clearwater. "You can try to think that there is something like it, but there's not. Being able to wear the colors of your country and represent something so much bigger than yourself, I'm really, really looking forward to this, and we've got a really good group of players." You know the team is loaded when Phillies shortstop Trey Turner, one of the heroes for the U.S. in the 2023 WBC, declined an invitation when told he would have to shift to second base. And Trout, who perhaps wouldn't have been cleared for insurance anyway, wasn't even invited. Certainly, there will be nerves by general managers watching their pitchers perform in the event. It really isn't a concern for position players, but pitchers must ramp up quicker than normal and throw into an environment that replicates the postseason, if not greater. "It's a great event," Buster Posey, Giants president of baseball operations, said earlier this spring. "But we've also seen over the years that it can derail some pitchers. just because there's no way to replicate getting yourself ready for what's essentially a playoff baseball atmosphere in early March. Still, injury risk or not, or leaving teammates behind, players absolutely love the event. "The WBC is great, man," said San Diego Padres All-Star third baseman Manny Machado, who is playing for the Dominican Republic. "I'm super excited. I think everybody in the world is waiting for it. It's just a cool event. You're playing for not just your country, not just for the fans, but for the people in their countries and across the world. I get goosebumps just talking about it because it's such a special event. The WBC is not only for national pride, but it breaks up the monotony of spring training. Players will stay at five-star hotels with their families, play in a postseason environment, and catch up with longtime friends. I think just wearing the stars and stripes across your chest is special for players," said Cubs starter Matthew Boyd, who will pitch for the USA. "And then, listening to the national anthem with the flag on your shoulder, that's the highest honor." Witt, who had only three plate appearances in the last WBC, is the starting shortstop this time around and says he can't wait to play alongside Crow Armstrong and infielder Bruce Duran, his teammates from an under-18 team. "Even before they asked if I'd play," Witt said, "the answer was yes. I loved the event, just being around the guys. It was unreal." Now, for the first time since they were teenagers and roommates, Witt and Crow Armstrong will be reunited on the same USA team. They were merely high school prospects at the time, manhandling the competition. Today, they are all-stars, with Witt, at 25, already establishing himself as one of the finest players in the game. "I immediately looked up to Bob," Crow Armstrong told USA Today Sports, "and to this day, he's probably the best player I've ever seen. It's not even close, and it's so cool what he's doing now. I just feel very lucky that I get to experience something like this. I'm ready to play some real, meaningful baseball and just wear those colors. I mean, I haven't done it for some years, and getting to do it now at the highest stage is going to be special." Yet, considering that Crow Armstrong already has a strong friendship with Witt, there is one star he'd love hanging out with during this two-week tournament. "Bryce Harper is the guy I'm looking forward to the most. Crow Armstrong said, "just being around people who have coached him or played with him. I'm just very excited to see him go about his business. He's been at the peak of everything for the longest time. He's done it in a very authentic way, in a very real way. He's done a lot of good things for the game, but just from a behind-the-scenes perspective, I'm excited to see him." Now, for the first time, they are all teammates, representing their countries and going for the gold. "I'm super proud of being an American," said Bregman, playing on his sixth USA team. "I take great pride in being from the United States. It's wearing the stars and stripes. You become a family and a team really quickly. Even though we're all in different camps right now, this week we'll be in the same clubhouse. That's the coolest part of it, the bond that's created right away when you step foot in that locker room and know what you're representing and what you're playing for." Now, here's another story to continue this sort of flag-waving theme that we've been on in the last two stories. This is from Bob Nightingale with USA Today. "They screamed and high-fived, they ran around, and then the chants began. USA, USA, USA." This was the scene in the Chicago Cubs and San Francisco Giants clubhouses, along with plenty of others throughout spring training the morning of February 22nd, the moment Jack Hughes scored the overtime goal to beat Canada for the USA's first men's hockey gold medal since 1980, 2 days after the women's gold medal win over Canada. I mean, we were all jumping in here, just going crazy, jumping up and down when Hughes scored. I mean, if that doesn't fire you up to play for your country, I don't know what does, Cubs all-star third baseman Alex Bregman told USA Today Sports. New York Mets pitcher Nolan McLean, who will be ready to pitch for Team USA this week in the World Baseball Classic, echoed Bregman's sentiments, talking to reporters in Port St. Lucie, Florida. "Just watching the hockey game, how hard these guys competed for their country. I think that is something that's firing me up even more than I already was, says Cubs center fielder Pete Crow Armstrong, who is playing for Team USA in the WBC. Man, we were all in here geeking. It's so cool, and now we get a chance to go for the gold too. 2 years from now, MLB hopes to replicate the same emotional scene in the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. It is expecting to allow its big league players to participate in the Olympics for the first time in history. I think people have come to appreciate that the Olympics on U.S. soil is a unique marketing opportunity for the game, Commissioner Rob Manfred said earlier in February. I think we've got a lot of players interested in doing it, and I feel pretty good about the idea that we'll get there. The MLB proposal with LA 28 organizers must be approved by the MLB Players Association, but the tentative plan is an extended All-Star break, permitting the Major League players to play in the summer games at Dodger Stadium. MLB still would have an All-Star game around its normal date, which likely would be played in San Diego, San Francisco, or Las Vegas. The selected players could then proceed to play in the six-day, six-team Olympic tournament from July 13th to the 19th. It's also why the WBC, which begins March 5th, has greater significance since the top two teams, besides the USA, would automatically qualify to be in the Olympics. The USA gets an automatic berth since it's the host country. I think everyone is super fired up for the Olympics after watching a hockey game, Cubs infielder outfielder Matt Shaw said. We had like 60 guys in here watching and yelling. It was such a cool thing. I mean, if there ever was such an opportunity to play in the Olympics, it would be so awesome. Right now, the WBC is our Olympics. I love watching that as much as the World Series, but to actually play in the Olympics? Wow. MVPs and All-Stars from Philadelphia Phillies first baseman Bryce Harper to LA Dodgers shortstop Mookie Betts and Phillies DH Kyle Schwarber have been advocating for years for the opportunity to play in the Olympics. Now, after negotiations with the LA 28 organizers, all that remains is the union signing off to finalize their childhood dreams. Representing your country, Harper told reporters in Florida, there's nothing better. The feeling of putting USA on your chest and playing for something so much bigger than yourself, representing your whole country, there's nothing greater. Says Betts, absolutely, absolutely, I want to play in the Olympics. It would be an unbelievable honor. Harper and other players on Team USA in the WBC were emotional talking about the hockey gold medal victory, calling it inspirational for their bid to win the gold again after losing to Japan in the 23 title game. This is our time to represent our country, Schwarber told reporters after the gold medal win. It gives you that motivation, you know, being that you're going to be heading into that and knowing what to expect. Obviously, we're not Olympians, but it's our mini-Olympics. The Americans' hockey gold medal games actually reinforced Dodgers manager Dave Roberts' desire to become the U.S. Olympic coach. Roberts, the son of a U.S. Marine sergeant, certainly is the natural choice with the USA games at Dodger Stadium, where he has led the Dodgers to three World Series championships. Roberts, who also graduated from UCLA, has international experience too, representing the U.S. at the 1999 Pan American Games. The tournament helped qualify the USA team for the 2000 Sydney Olympics, where the USA won the gold medal with Dodgers Hall of Fame manager Tommy Lasorda. We talk about doing things bigger than yourselves, Roberts said, and then being part of something for your country and watching the USA team. That was fun for both men and women. So if I do have that opportunity, that would be something I'd be very excited about and very humbled. It's hard to imagine a bigger honor. While players relish playing in the WBC, they didn't grow up watching the WBC. It came into existence only in 2006. But virtually everyone grew up watching the Olympics at some juncture in their lives. I mean, I love the Olympics, said Cubs starter Matthew Boyd, who will be playing for the first time in the WBC. I love hockey. Growing up, USA could never beat Canada. They just had such a lineup of dudes. Canada was so superior in that sport. We were always fired up for USA versus Canada. So, I mean, it's very cool that we can go representing our country right after that. It really fires me up, and it's so exciting for us. Schwarber says the Olympic experience would take it to a different level. We all grew up watching the Olympics and being kids, just tuning into all different kinds of events, Schwarber said. Back in the day, the TV dinners, you go get the pullout tray, throw it on the couch, and all the family sitting down at night, we're watching the Olympics. We're watching the gymnasts, the swimming, the diving. Those were all big ones. I loved watching the sprinters run. It'd just be great for our game in general. Everyone would see it, and it might reach a broader audience than just some countries that are really tuned into it. This will be the third time Los Angeles is hosting the Summer Olympics, the last in 1984. The Americans finished runner-up in the baseball demonstration tournament, losing to Japan in the championship game. That collegiate team featured future stars like Hall of Famers Barry Larkin, home run champion Mark McGwire, and All-Stars Will Clark and Bobby Witt. 13 players from the team were selected in the first round of the 1985 draft. Now, more than 40 years later, Witt's son, Bobby Witt Jr., could be playing in the Olympics too. He will be a primary shortstop in the Americans' WBC team this year. It's so cool representing your country, Witt Jr. said, and you're coming together as one. What's better than that? When Ohtani and Dodgers starter Yoshinobu Yamamoto were asked this spring which meant more to them, winning the World Series for the Dodgers or winning a gold medal for Japan, they said it was impossible to choose. That would be so cool playing for your country, Dodgers teammate Blake Snell said. That's the ultimate, playing for your country. It would be way bigger than the WBC. Perhaps Dodgers reliever Jack Dreyer best summed up the feelings by every player dreaming one day to be selected for that 28 Olympic team. It would be incredible to be an Olympian, Dreyer said. I think the only thing more special than playing in the big leagues would be to represent your country. The World Baseball Classic is great, but the Olympics is just unreal. Can you imagine? All right, let's switch sports for a period of time here and read a story by Michael Middlehurst Swartz from USA Today. By definition, the NFL draft is inherently a young man's game. But while there are no literal graybeards among this year's class of prospects, a number of players are set to become rookies despite resembling veterans in age. And they're doing so at a moment when personal decision makers have reconsidered long-standing aversion to older prospects. If it's close between players and you have a 20-year-old and a 25-year-old, obviously you're going to take the 20-year-old, NFL Network draft analyst Daniel Jeremiah said last week at a scouting combine. But teams are not as concerned with the age going through this process. With the NCAA in 2020 granting an extra year of eligibility to all players, the NFL saw a 3-year spike in draftees who were 24 years or older, peaking in 24 with 56 selected. This year's total won't approach that high water mark, with a smaller group constituting the last wave of 60-year seniors. But with the NIL boom driving a substantial reduction in underclassmen declarations, 63 this year, less than half the number from 5 years ago, it's readily apparent that the latest class is continuing to skew older and more experienced, and NFL front offices, having already rethought their previous norms around age, are prepared. I don't believe a 25-year-old is old, Cincinnati Bengals Director of Player Personnel Duke Tobin said. I think a 25-year-old is young, still has a lot of football left in his body. It's a data point. It's something we're aware of and might affect the longevity down the road, but sometimes it can also be a benefit in a guy being more mature in his body or a little more stable in how he conducts himself in his personal life. Age is a number. Guys are playing longer these days. It's a factor, but it's not a big factor for us. There's a clear choice for the flag bearer of this year's 24 and up movement, Miami defensive end Akeem Mesitor, who will turn 25 in April prior to the April Draft wears his age proudly. The Ottawa native blossomed in his final season with the Hurricanes, recording 12.5 sacks and helping lead the charge for the Hurricanes' run to the national championship game. Now he could join Reuben Bain Jr., his more hyped pass-rushing partner, in the first round. For Messidor, his typical timeline for arriving in the pros is a source of strength. "You can call me a seasoned rookie, whatever you want to call it," Messidor said with a smile at the combine. "I'm coming in more mature, with a different approach and a different mentality than a lot of younger players." There are a handful of other 24-year-old offensive and defensive linemen joining Messidor in this class. In recent years, the fronts have often featured the heaviest volume of similarly aged players, Green Bay Packers general manager Brian Gutekunst said. An age outlier, however, can be found at almost any position. The phenomenon was thrust into the spotlight in 24 when quarterbacks Michael Penix Jr. and Bo Nix were each selected in the top 12 picks, despite being sixth-year seniors who were already 24 on draft day. Tyler Shough represented an even more extreme test case for teams, as the seventh-year senior and eventual second-round pick of the New Orleans Saints turned 26 before making his first start last fall. This year, UConn quarterback Joe Fagnano, a former Maine transfer and possible late-round pick, also was invited to the combine after staying in the collegiate ranks for 8 years. At running back, South Carolina's Rasul Faison turned 26 last month. He's multiple months older than both the Dallas Cowboys' Javonte Williams and the Los Angeles Rams' Kyren Williams, each of whom has logged more than 800 carries in the NFL and already signed a second contract. When it comes to positions that allow for shorter career windows, the notion of using a pick on a player who has a limited time left to remain at or near his athletic peak can be daunting. Miami cornerback Keontae Scott has a counter argument. "I've heard that going around, but I feel like this game that we play is a window game, or a winnow game, rather. That takes a lot of the age things away. These teams, some of those coaches, don't have time to waste. When you play this game, it doesn't matter how old you are." First-year Miami Dolphins general manager John Eric Sullivan agrees, but with a caveat. "I think if you can help it, you don't want a player close to going into a second contract around 30 years old," Sullivan said. Having said that, with the climate of college football, there are situations where you're going to have to consider that to get good football players. But Jeremiah cited a running joke among football circles. Amid all the focus on second contracts for older draft prospects, general managers are also seeking additional contracts of their own, and therefore pursue immediate assistance in whatever form it might come. "Let's try to get 4 or 5 good years out of this player, and if he gives us that and we move on, it's a good pick," Jeremiah said. The reality of the current draft dynamic hit Kansas City Chiefs general manager Brett Veach in January. That's when the league holds its annual underclassmen declaration deadline. With so many players opting to go back to school, the Chiefs removed approximately 25 prospects from the team's board of the overall top 75 to 100. And it really impacts the draft, and there are some older prospects as you go on, Veach said. "I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, and there's something that we have to adapt to until there are some wholesale changes in the college side. I think this is just the way things are going to work out now." Gutekunst, however, isn't so sure that the draft landscape will remain this way for the foreseeable future. "I think for the next year or so that we'll be in that window, and then we'll gradually graduate out of it," Gutekunst said. The biggest fallout for the league can be in its developmental pipeline. "This is often reflected on the second day of the draft," Veach said, "which is frequently the landing spot for some players who have a wide gulf between their promise and their pro readiness. Typically, in the second or third round would be those guys who didn't play a lot, but they're young," Veach said. "Well, Now they're just bouncing to another school and getting paid while playing. So with these younger developmental guys, you're getting a bit more of a finished product. Regardless of whether the pool of prospect changes or not, NFL decision makers have already made up their minds on the issue. In his first draft as general manager of the Las Vegas Raiders, John Spytek selected two players who had already turned 24, third-round cornerback Darian Porter and sixth-round wide receiver Tommy Mellott. With a robust roster reset at hand, Spytek didn't want age to be a disqualifying factor. Our analytics department gets mad at me sometimes, or anytime we put a guy up who's a little bit older, Spytek said, but we're just looking for good football players. And speaking of the NFL draft, here's the leading off column from the USA Today Sports Weekly. This is by Jarrett Bell, who's a columnist with USA Today. Just before 8 a.m. in Hall J of the Indianapolis Convention Center on February 27th, the promised one stepped to the podium. Fernando Mendoza, with his broad, engaging smile, unassuming manners, and, well, humility, seemed as if he had just bolted over from Central Casting. Lucky Las Vegas Raiders. This is what a franchise quarterback is supposed to look like, supposed to sound like. Sure, as Mendoza, 22, alluded to during his 13-minute media session, there is no cookie cutter when it comes to what constitutes an NFL star. Lamar Jackson looks and sounds nothing like Josh Allen, who looks and sounds nothing like the great Patrick Mahomes. Big-time ballers come in all shapes, shades, and sizes. Still, if you're that team that for so many years has wallowed in mediocrity, hey, silver and black, and been unable to get out of its own way as it cycled through one coach after another, one quarterback after another, in matching Mendoza with the number one pick in the upcoming draft, you are revived by the idea that miracles can indeed happen. Somewhere, Al Davis is crowing. Not only does Mendoza look the part, he's fresh off leading Indiana, yes, Indiana, to the national crown. He won the Heisman, and he's tough. For all of his big stats and highlight throws, winning the Natty came down to Mendoza barreling into the end zone like somebody's Bronco Nagurski. The kid will sell tickets, but most of all, he can play. And hey, some of us think he has jokes, too. The pick has not been selected yet, Mendoza said, of what lies ahead when the Raiders turn in the draft card on April 23rd. Whatever team drafts me, I'm extremely grateful. Like I said, if I was the number one pick, or whether it's the last pick in the draft, I'd be blessed and honored to play, to be picked by any team, giving them my all. The last pick in the draft? Is he kidding? Then again, that Mendoza seemingly will take nothing for granted is one reason Raiders rookie coach Clint Kubiak can count his blessings. In explaining his obsession with minute details, Mendoza pointed out how he was the nation's 134th ranked quarterback coming out of high school. And look at him now. He's a poster child for details. That was a true ranking, Mendoza reflected. I was a raw prospect. I was terrible. And it's about the small wins every day. And now, the big wins. The NFL scouting combine represented Mendoza's opening act on an NFL stage, with the medical exams, meat market measurements, interviews, and the like. As you'd expect, quarterback 11 drew the biggest crowd of any, probably all week, at his podium. The first impression was textbook. Someone asked Mendoza if he had updated his LinkedIn profile. Well, right now I'm unemployed, Mendoza said. I have no job. So this is my job interview right now, and like everyone says, it's the most important job interview of your life. So right now, I'm just trying to do everything to hopefully get employed. Yeah, the kid can spin it in more ways than one. Tom Brady is going to love pouring into Mendoza, and vice versa. Brady, the Raiders' minority owner who entered the NFL as a sixth-round pick, wasn't on sight as Mendoza went through the combine paces. Even though Brady attended the national championship game with Raiders owner Mark Davis, he's yet to meet Mendoza in person. But it's coming. When Mendoza met with key Raiders power brokers at the combine, the session began with a quick telephone hookup with Brady. I was able to say a brief hi on the phone to Brady, Mendoza said, and so that was very special to me, and I look forward to meeting him in person, hopefully, one day. Hopefully, he admits, it goes much deeper than that. Given Brady's investment in the Raiders, with competitive football juices layered on top of his financial stake, Mendoza is seemingly on the verge of gaining the best resource any young quarterback could dream of. No, it doesn't seem fair. Brady won 7 Super Bowl rings, gets a piece of the Raiders, doubles with his high-profile role as a Fox Sports analyst, and is now poised, too, to tutor a quarterback with star potential. That opportunity would be fantastic, Mendoza gushed. Tom Brady, I believe, is the greatest quarterback of all time by a wide margin, and to be able to be mentored by him, it would mean so much, especially to learn, and I'm all about learning. So from day one, I've got to learn a lot. It's going to be a long journey, and so to potentially have a mentor like that, it would be pretty impressive and pretty meaningful. Mendoza will need plenty of support beyond Brady. Too often, that is, teams land their franchise quarterback of the future with a high draft pick, only to fail to put pieces around him. Ask Sam Darnold, who just won a Super Bowl with the Seahawks years after the New York Jets were supposed to take off with him at quarterback. Then again, sometimes it goes both ways. Look at the Indianapolis Colts, open for trade offers for Anthony Richardson, drafted 4th overall in 23. The Colts failed the quarterback, and the quarterback failed the team, with bad luck on top of that equation. In Mendoza's case, though, he seems built for this moment after a circuitous journey from his hometown of Miami to Cal to IU and 3 years starting on the college level. He also seems well-equipped to handle the spotlight and pressure. He knows, with his status and position, leadership is an essential component for his expectations, for their expectations. He can ask Brady all about that. I believe that with an NFL franchise, to lead it, you need equity, Mendoza said, and you need 2 things to build equity. Number one, you want to play well. That's where all my focus goes, football, football, football. If you want to lead, you've got to play well first. And second, to have the respect of your teammates through work ethic, through your leadership, through your tenacity, the way that you respond to mistakes. And so those things are all things I'm going to work on. Sounds like a plan. Even if the Raiders don't select him, with the number one pick. Okay, I had scheduled myself to read a couple of player profile stories from Major League Baseball, but as neither of these players is from the Diamondbacks or even from our Western Division, and because I happen to like college basketball and there are no college basketball stories in this week's paper, I'm going to shift and read something from ESPN Sports. The subject is the men's college basketball power rankings. The subheadline is Biggest Stakes for Champ Week. This is by Jeff Borzello. The final men's college basketball power rankings of the 25-26 season shows a clear delineation between the teams at the top of the rankings and everyone else. Entering last season's NCAA tournament, there was a 4-team tier at the top, the 4 number one seeds. It resulted in a Final Four featuring all 4 number one seeds for the first time since 2008. Are we headed for a similar national semifinal this year? Duke, Michigan, and Arizona have separated themselves from the pack for weeks, while Florida's recent dominant run has the Gators pushing to join that tier. UConn's predictive numbers are not at the level of those 4, but as things currently stand, the Huskers have the inside track to the 4th number one seed. One more UConn stumble, though, and Florida could find itself back on the top line. What else is at stake among ranked teams during the final regular season weekend? In the ACC, Duke can maintain its number one ranking with a home win over North Carolina. In the Big East, UConn and St. John's are tied for first place with one game remaining. UConn heads to Marquette while the Johnnies play at Seton Hall. In the Big Ten, seeding in both the conference and NCAA tournaments is on the line. Michigan State's surge up the board could continue with a successful trip to Ann Arbor, while Illinois' two-seed quest requires a win at Maryland. In the Big 12, Iowa State and Kansas both desperately need to stop their losing runs, and Texas Tech's post-JT Toppin resume could use a bounce back at BYU. In the SEC, Florida has to win at Kentucky to continue its rise toward a one seed. Now, for our final top 25 ahead of the regular season finales. Number one is the Duke Blue Devils. 28-2 is their record, and their previous ranking was also number one. Duke has entered a different level of dominance over the past couple of weeks, moving past Michigan in each of the efficiency-based metrics on the NCAA team sheets. The Blue Devils' last ACC win by fewer than 13 points came back on January 10th against SMU, and their average margin of victory in 12 league wins since is 24.5 points. Three of their five most efficient offensive performances of the season have come in the past five games, including scoring at a 1.44 points possession clip in Monday's win over NC State. They've also held six straight ACC opponents to fewer than 1 point per possession. Over the next 7 days, they play against North Carolina and in the ACC tournament. Number two is our Arizona Wildcats, 28-2, previous ranking number two. Arizona's two-game lull seems to be firmly in the past, as the Wildcats handled their business this past week, clinching the Big 12 regular season title with two dominant wins over Kansas and Iowa State by a combined 39 points. Their elite defense had struggled for a few weeks, allowing at least 1.02 points per possession in five straight games, but it held both the Jayhawks and Cyclones to below 0.9 points per possession. Monday's win over Iowa State also featured another big game performance from Jaden Bradley, who finished with 17 points. Per ESPN research, Bradley is now averaging 17.6 points against top 10 opponents and 13.1 against all others. The next 7 days has Arizona at Colorado and the Big 12 tournament coming up. At number three is the Michigan Wolverines. They're 27-2. Previous ranking was also number three. Michigan bounced back from its loss to Duke with back-to-back wins over Minnesota and Illinois, then received bad news with L.J. Kaysen suffering a torn ACL and being ruled out for the season. Kaysen had emerged as one of the best backup guards in the country and was playing his best basketball of the season over the past few weeks. The Florida native had scored in double figures in five of his last seven games heading into the Illinois game, including shooting 54.2% from three. Without Kaysen, the point guard duties will fall almost exclusively to Elliot Cadeau, while freshman Trey McKinney will also become more important as the primary reserve in the backcourt. In the next 7 days, Michigan faces Iowa and Michigan State, and then the Big Ten tournament. At number four, there are the UConn Huskies, who are 27-3 and were also ranked number four in the last rankings. UConn has rebounded nicely from its mini slump in the first half of February when it lost twice in four games, and we're starting to see elite level performance at both ends of the floor. The Huskies are ranked 11th nationally in adjusted offensive efficiency since January 27, but after a couple of weeks of subpar defense, they're back to playing their best at that end of the floor, ranking 5th in the nation in adjusted defensive efficiency during their current three-game winning streak. While some of that is buoyed by their dominance against St. John's, they were also highly impressive against Villanova and overcame an uncharacteristically strong three-point shooting night from Seton Hall. Their next 7 days includes Marquette and the Big East tournament. At number five, we have the Florida Gators at 24-6. Their previous ranking was number six, so they're up one. We won't go as far as saying Florida is playing better than it was at this point in last year's national championship run, but it's not far off. The Gators are absolutely obliterating opponents. They've had one win by fewer than 13 points since January 28th, and they won both games in the last week by a combined score of 219-151. There are some eye-popping stats coming out of their recent stretch, but this might have been the best one. According to ESPN research, Florida's streak of 90-plus points in six straight games against ranked opponents is the third longest in a single season in AP poll history. The only teams with longer streaks are UNLV and Loyola Marymount, with both coming in 89 and 90. Their next 7 days at Florida are with Kentucky and the SEC tournament. At number seven, there are the Houston Cougars, who have moved up from number eight. The Cougars are 25-5. Order has been restored in Houston after the Cougars had previously lost three in a row to tumble out of the Big 12 title race. Kelvin Sampson's team won both of its games this past week, and it was the perimeter group that, unsurprisingly, sparked the wins. Against Colorado, Milos Uzon broke out for 26 points and 6 assists, while Kingston Flemings and Emmanuel Sharp were also in double figures. And against Baylor, Flemings was the star with 21 points and 7 assists, while Sharp went for 19 points and Uzon had 12. We would be remiss, however, if we didn't mention the interior production from Joseph Tugler. One of the knocks on Houston during its losing streak was the lack of a go-to post option that it had last year in Juwan Roberts. But Tugler had 14 points in each of his past two games, his first time since mid-January scoring in double figures in back-to-back games. Their next seven games includes Oklahoma State and then the Big 12 tournament. At number seven, Michigan State is ranked. Michigan State is 24-5, and their previous ranking is number 13, so they've jumped up quite a bit. The Spartans have rattled off four straight wins, including road victories at Purdue and Indiana, and they're now squarely in the hunt for a two seed in the NCAA tournament, with room to improve after favorable results in the regular season final against Michigan, as well as the Big Ten tournament. They rank in the top 10 in four of the seven metrics on the NCAA team sheet, and their 15 combined quadrant 1 and 2 wins ranked behind only five teams nationally entering the week. In fact, only four teams entered the week with more than Michigan State's 8 quad 1 wins. Their next 7 days includes games at Rutgers and Michigan before the Big Ten tournament. Speaking of the Big Ten, at number 8, we find the Fighting Illini from Illinois. They're 23-7, and they're up from number 9 ranking last week. Since suffering a high ankle sprain on February 7th, Andrei Stojakovic, who started the 21 of the first 24 games of the season, missed two games, then came off the bench for the last four. But the former Stanford and Cal transfer hasn't exactly found it easy to get into a consistent rhythm. He scored 22 points in his first game back from injury, then had 8 points on 1-for-5 shooting against UCLA, and was scoreless in 12 minutes against Michigan. Brad Underwood will hope Stojakovic's performance against Oregon on Tuesday, with 21 points, 12 rebounds, and 7-for-12 from the field in just 21 minutes, gets him back on track. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, sports fans. Once again, this is Kent Batty, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.